You only have to watch a few TV police dramas to get used to the reading of the Miranda rights to people getting arrested. They include, if you cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed to you. Right to representation is in the Constitution in the Sixth Amendment, and court cases over the years have extended that right to people who can't afford lawyers. But the system for providing and paying for lawyers for criminal defendants varies from state to state, and a recent report shows some problems with Oregon's system. It's from the Sixth Amendment Center based in Boston, where David Carroll is the executive director, and he's one of our guests. David, welcome.
Thank you.
John Mosher is with us as well. He's the deputy director of 6AC. Thank you for joining us as well.
Good morning.
So, David, why don't you start us off? Both of you apparently have long experience with right-to-counsel cases, but it sounds like the Sixth Amendment Center is not that old itself.
Yes, we're about 6 years old. We were created to give a place for policymakers to go to understand what the parameters are they need to meet to effectively fulfill the Sixth Amendment right to counsel. But we've been doing this work in one form or another. I've been doing it for more than 20 years, and John for certainly more than 10 years.
And so, John, I wonder, as you look around the country, I mean, how much variation do you see in the quality of representation from state to state?
You know, it's really interesting. You see a lot of states that struggle with things like independence of counsel. Some states do it better than others, and one of the things that we recommended for Oregon is that they address independence through creating a statewide commission that meets national standards by ensuring that the Public Defense Commission that exists today in Oregon has diverse appointing authorities. And you can look to certain states like Massachusetts that actually has diverse appointing authorities and others. But other states struggle with independence that can affect quality of representation.
And so it sounds like a couple of measures there that you just indicated that you look at. What other things do you look at when you're assessing the quality of a state's public defender system?
There's a number of things. There's a United States Supreme Court case called United States v. Chronic that lays out the systemic parameters that have to be met for effective representation. Besides the independence issue that John raised, they ask that, do attorneys have sufficient time to properly represent a case? Are attorneys properly qualified to handle the types of cases they are appointed to? And are they appointed early enough in the process to be effective? So those are the type of issues that we're looking at all across Oregon.
And David, did the U.S. versus Chronic case do what it was intended to do, what the ruling was supposed to do? Because it seems like it's since the Chronic case, which is, 84, I think we've heard of more cases where, public court-appointed lawyers fell asleep while they're defending their clients on murder cases and things like that.
Yeah, so Chronic was decided the same day as a case called Strickland v. Washington, which tends to be the case where people look at if the individual lawyer was effective within a case or not. And there's actually a presumption in Strickland that all the parameters of Chronic have already been met. And so I think the case you brought up of the sleeping lawyer, for instance, they didn't do a Chronic analysis first. I think they may have found out there was judicial interference, that the attorney had too many cases, all the things, but they didn't raise it as a Chronic claim. They raised it as a Strickland claim. So I think there's been a lot of focus over the past 30 years on Strickland, when in fact the real deficiencies we see in our country are really Chronic claims.
We were talking about the right to counsel in Oregon, which is, in fact, the name of the report coming from the Sixth Amendment Center based in Boston that took a look at Oregon's public defender system and found some deficiencies. We'll get into those deficiencies in just a moment with David Carroll, the executive director of 6AC, and John Mosher, the deputy director. If you have questions or comments or have always wondered about how the whole public defender system works, you can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So at the top of the control of public defense in Oregon, it's the Public Defense Services Commission, the PDSC. And I understand the PDSC actually asked you to come in and take a look at the system?
That's correct. We had been talking for a little while about the need to do a comprehensive review there. And they had asked the legislature to fund such a study so that we could come in and give an objective look as to what's going on.
Now, it does, you know, it makes a certain amount of sense in a state as physically large as Oregon that you're not going to get to all the counties, and you didn't. But how did you choose which ones to take a look at?
We actually didn't choose. We find it a little presumptuous for us to come in and tell people what a sample of counties would be reflective of that state. We don't know your state as well as the policymakers and criminal justice practitioners. And so what we always ask is that they form an advisory committee that involves all three branches of government, of state government, local government, and criminal justice policymakers. We ask them to choose a relative sample. Generally, it's somewhere around 10% of the total number of counties in a state. And so we ended up going to 9 different counties to really drill down, do courtroom observations and interviews with the practitioners and criminal justice stakeholders like judges and prosecutors and sheriffs. And so the counties that we went to were Clackamas, Douglas, Grant, Harney, Lane, Marion, Morrow, Multnomah, and Umatilla counties.
Okay, so in fact, when you get into 9 counties, you got 25% of Oregon at least geographically represented, or at least by the number of counties, which is that's better than 15%. I wonder about what the main deficiencies were that you found. I mean, let me back up as a step, because I noticed looking at the maps state by state at the 6AC website that California, for example, has a slightly different system county by county, but Oregon's pretty uniform, isn't it?
Well, it's all paid for by the state, which tends to be a better funding model than counties by counties. When you do it county by county, the counties that are generally most in need of indigent defense services are the ones that are least likely to be able to provide it, because things like low property rates, people leaving counties, high unemployment, those often are the same indicators of high crime. So county by county is the least stable form of indigent defense funding. So Oregon started with 100% state funding, and we expected it to be, a fairly robust system. And what we found was that despite this complex bureaucracy they've created through the Public Defender Services Commission and the Office of Public Defense Services, they actually have very little oversight and financial accountability. So at no point can the state say they know who is providing representation, in which cases, how many cases an attorney carries, and whether they have sufficient time to be carrying those or not. That's fairly incredible for a state that's putting out as much money as they are to not know how it's actually being spent on the ground.
This explains the term you guys use, which rather jumps out in the report, a stunning lack of oversight. So who should be checking up, and what should they be checking on?
Well, the case of Gideon versus Wainwright is not just a Sixth Amendment case, it's a 14th Amendment case. And it says that the state is responsible for ensuring effective representation. So the start of that is that the state has to have a process to determine whether or not there is effective representation at the local level. And what we're saying is that this whole complex system they built in OPDS just isn't doing that. You know, they need to be able to have basic data that says, the attorneys are qualified to handle these cases and that they have sufficient time to do so. And they just don't do that. And the main cause of that is that they have what we call fixed-fee contracts that create financial conflicts of interest between the due process rights of the defendants and the attorneys trying to put food on their family's table.
So this is a really interesting part of this, the compensation part. So I'm getting the sense from what I read in the report that if the attorney spends 15 minutes or 15 hours on a case, the pay is the same?
That's basically it, yeah, is that there's an incentive to do as little on the case as possible.
Or flipped it around, a bit of a disincentive to put a lot of time and attention into the work.
That's correct.
Well, we are talking to the folks at the Sixth Amendment Center in Boston about a recent study they did of the public defender system in Oregon. You'll hear us using the acronyms OPDS, which is Oregon Public Defense Services, which answers to the Public Defense Services Commission, PDSC, nominally. But there's obviously some issues with how the system is administered at Oregon. David Carroll, the executive director at the Sixth Amendment Center. John Mosher, the deputy director. You can join us on the exchange with your questions, your comments, your experiences, perhaps, if you've ever encountered the public defender system from either side of the transaction. We would like to hear from you. 800-838-3760 over the phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So let's talk about the fixing the money part of this first. Or do you think, based on your analysis, that the oversight needs to be fixed before you can even address the money?
I think the oversight has to come first. For years now, the Public Defender Services Commission was appointed by the Chief Justice. And I think it basically let the legislature and the executive branches off the hook to sort of say, oh, well, that's their dealing with it. We don't need to worry about it. And it's not that the judiciary is trying to undermine the right to counsel. In fact, I think the opposite's true. It's just that the judiciary tends not to be the best politicians in trying to explain what's needed and why. And so I do think straightening out the commission so that there are equal appointees from all three branches of government, and then they work with OPDS to create the plan on how to provide services better. And we point the way and say, you need to abolish this fixed-fee contract system altogether and pay attorneys a reasonable fee in addition to their overhead costs if you're going to keep a private attorney system, or you can convert people to staffed government public defenders. There's no real off-the-shelf cookie-cutter model that must be employed everywhere. Those are decisions that rightfully should be made locally, but they do need to figure out what the model direction they want to do. And most likely, my guess is it's going to end up with a mixed system. I just don't think there's the caseload in, for instance, Eastern Oregon to ever require public defenders full-time. At the same time, in Western Oregon, certainly Northwestern, there's plenty of cases to be able to start moving some of those people to staff government positions to get out from under those financial conflicts of interest.
Right. You mentioned Grant and Harney County, where there aren't that many criminal cases, period, versus Clackamas and Multnomah, where there are just gobs of them all the time. So do I understand correctly that there are no public defenders who are employed by, they're not public employees, they're still in private practice, but hired on contract?
That's correct. We have, it manifests itself differently county by county, but in each one of the counties, regardless of whether it's a full-time attorney employed by a nonprofit office, a nonprofit law firm, that law firm has a contract with OPDS, or if it's a consortium of private lawyers who band together to enter into a contract with OPDS, it's still a contract system. And so those contracts are let with the same sorts of conflicts of interest that David was talking about earlier, where it's a single flat fee per case that incentivizes each one of the providers to take on more and more cases in order to increase the level of pay. And as they do that, that same nonprofit law firm that employs full-time lawyers and that same consortium of attorneys has similar conflicts of interest built in through that contract model.
So,
but none of them are actually government employees.
All right. This looks primarily like a management analysis. I mean, was there any assessment made of the quality of representation based on actions directly in court?
Yes. But what so your followers understand, this isn't looking at individual attorneys and saying, you know, this person's good, that person should be off the panel. It's really a systemic look about do they have the checks and balances in place to tell the difference between the good and bad attorneys. And we should say and make this very clear, we saw lots of very good lawyering across the state. It's not that anyone involved in this system is a bad lawyer by any stretch of the imagination. It's just the state has the 14th Amendment obligation to be able to ensure that anyone that's appointed a lawyer is going to get an effective lawyer. And that's what they can't distinguish right now with their current system.
Is the system shaky enough from your viewing of it that it might be ripe for a target for a constitutional lawsuit?
There's a lot of systemic class action lawsuits going on across the country, and indeed, much in the states right around you. Washington has a lawsuit from the ACLU, Idaho, Nevada, Utah, and then lots of places across the country besides just your immediate neighbors. California is being sued by the ACLU. So it's certainly something that is not out of the realm of possibilities. We do not get involved in litigation ourselves, and I've learned never to speak for the ACLU of what they will and will not do. But there's certainly enough issues there that I think the state has exposure.
Another phrase that jumps out of the report is misdemeanors matter. What does that mean in this context?
So misdemeanors generally is the place where people will first come in contact with the criminal justice system. And I think it's, if you ask almost anyone on the street, they may know someone who's been picked up on a misdemeanor. You know, it might be a co-worker's son or someone in their congregation or something. And it seems like, well, you don't go to jail for very long, so they're not really that important. But even if you go to jail for just 30 days, that could have huge collateral consequences on someone's life. They could lose their job. They could lose their professional licenses. They could lose their student loans. There's lots of things that churn out from a misdemeanor conviction. And so if we focus on misdemeanors, I think we can perhaps, intervene and change some of the behaviors that may escalate in later years and lead to felonies. And what happens in Oregon right now is the PDSC, the commission, only oversees a certain number of courts. So any misdemeanors that are brought in municipal courts, for instance, are not even under the purview of the commission.
Okay, and so I have to leave it there because this is obviously one thing that's going to get some attention as the PDSC considers its response to the report. It is called The Right to Counsel in Oregon, brought in by the Sixth Amendment Center at the invitation of the Public Defense Services Commission. David Carroll is the Executive Director of 6AC, and John Mosher, the Deputy Director. Thank you for joining us.